Last week, my family and I spent Christmas and New Year's in Nebraska with my parents. They live in Lincoln, Nebraska. And last Friday, we took a drive from Lincoln to the Missouri River, Omaha. The Missouri River is the border on the very eastern edge of Nebraska. It's the border between Nebraska and Iowa. So we drove about an hour from Lincoln to Omaha to the Missouri River. Now, the Missouri River is a major river, if you've ever seen it. It's quite wide. It's very deep. In fact, I learned that it's also the longest river in the United States. It's just slightly longer than the Mississippi River. The Missouri begins, the headwaters are up in Montana, and it flows all the way down to St. Louis, where it then goes into the Mississippi. But it's wide, it's deep, it moves rapidly. In fact, it's a big enough river that some major boats can go up and down it to carry cargo and so on. So a fair number of large cities have developed over time along the Missouri River. But on our way to the Missouri River, we crossed over what's called the Platte River. Now, the Platte River, if the Missouri runs north and south, the Platte runs east and west. It runs right across the state of Nebraska, almost cuts it right in half. And eventually, the Platte empties into the Missouri. And on our drive to the Missouri, we drove over the Platte. And the interesting thing is, from the naked eye, the Platte is a more impressive river than the Missouri. The Platte is even wider than the Missouri. It looks like a huge river. Now, the Platte was named the Platte by some French explorers back in the 1800s who laid eyes on this huge, wide river. And then when they got down into the river, they realized this river is about a mile wide and an inch deep. Literally. And so they called it the Platte River, which means the flat river, because it's so shallow. In fact, the word Nebraska is an Indian word for shallow water, based on this shallow but wide river that runs through the state. Okay, you wanted to know all about Nebraska, right? But here's the point. You have these two rivers, one that feeds into the other, and the one is even wider than the other. The Platte is wider than the Missouri, but the Missouri runs deep, whereas the Platte is very shallow. As they say, it's a mile wide and an inch deep. And I know this from personal experience, because when I was in college, I went to school in Nebraska. One of our favorite Sabbath afternoon activities was to go floating on the Platte River. And we would get as many college kids as we could to go with us. And sometimes there'd be someone who'd say, no, I can't go inner tubing with you because I don't know how to swim. And we'd say, it's no problem. If you fall off your inner tube, all you do is stand up. Because literally, it's that shallow. Now, nobody in their personal life wants to be the Platte River. Nobody wants to be called shallow. We all want to be deep, right? Nobody wants to be shallow. A couple years ago, there was a movie that came out called Shallow Hal. Any of you see the movie Shallow Hal? Okay, I didn't, but I heard that Shallow Hal is based on a guy who, all he sees is women's exterior. He doesn't see anything about their inner beauty. Imagine that, a guy who only sees women for their external appearances. But he's shallow how? Because he only sees the external. He doesn't see the depth. And nobody wants to be a shallow how. Nobody wants to be superficial Sue. Okay, we all want to be people of depth. We want to live deep lives. We want to have substance in our lives. We don't want to be the Platte River, we want to be the Missouri River. Because deep is good, right? I mean, if you're with your friends, what kind of conversation do you want to have? want to have deep conversation eventually. If you're an astronomer, what kind of space do you want to look into? You want to look into deep space, right? Philosophers, they want to think deep thoughts. If you're a gardener, you want the roots of your plants to go deep into the soil. If you are a coach of a team, you want to have a deep bench. And if you're a fan of a certain team, you want your team to go deep into the playoffs. Investors are hoping for a deep recovery. Not a shallow recovery, but a deep recovery. So we want to be people of depth. We want things deep. Because deep, again, implies substance. If our lives, if we can say that we live deep lives, then it means that our lives are weighty. It means that our lives matter. It means they have substance, that they're sufficient. They're substantial. We want to be that kind of person. And if it's true of people in general that they want to be deep people, then it's especially true of people who call themselves Christians to say that they want their faith to be a deep faith. Right? We want to say that our faith is deep. Nobody wants to say that they go to a shallow or superficial church. Nobody wants a shallow faith. So I'm going to begin this year, 2012, with a sermon series that I'm calling Going Deep. Because that's the kind of faith that we want to have. And I've decided to focus on a little teeny tiny book that's buried way at the end of the New Testament. It's the book of 1 John. It's a book often we don't pay a lot of attention to. But it's a book that's written by a pastor to his church. John is writing to a church that's probably in Ephesus. And it's a church that's been around for a while. And they're facing some issues, and he has some concerns. And in the book of 1 John, John doesn't cover a wide variety of topics. Like when you read the writings of Paul, Paul often covers a multitude of subjects. But John just picks a couple key subjects that he thinks are really important for his church, and then he goes deep on those few subjects. And so over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be reading this book of 1 John and trying to figure out what is it that John was saying to his church in Ephesus 2,000 years ago that applies to Sunnyside today in terms of people who are trying to go deep in their faith. People who want a Missouri River kind of faith. And the gist of 1 John, in my opinion, is found in 1 John 2, verses 24 and 25. And I'm going to read that to you. 1 John 2, 24 to 25. And I'm reading this from the Message translation. John says, "Stay with what you heard from the beginning, the original message. Let it sink deep into your life. If what you heard from the beginning lives deeply in you, you will live deeply in both the Son and the Father." So this is where I got the title, Going Deep, because John talks about it here. Let me read it again. He says, "Stay with what you heard from the beginning, the original message. Let it sink deep into your life." And so my question is, what is it that John says, let this sink deep into your life? He says, stay with what you heard from the beginning. Stay with the original message and let it sink deep into your life. And so the question is, well, what's the original message? What's this thing that we've heard from the beginning that we need to go deep with? And that's what we're going to get into in the coming weeks. And so this morning, we're going to focus on not the text that I just read, but the one that Scott read a few minutes ago, which are the opening first four verses from this book. Scott read it from the Amplified Version, which I really like. I wish I had read that one. I'm going to read it to you from the New International Version, and then we're going to get into it. 1 John 1, 1 through 4. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared. We have seen it and testify to it. And we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. And we write this to make our joy complete. Now, I don't know what you were thinking as you heard me read that. I'll tell you what I was thinking when I read it this week. What in the world am I going to say about that? Because honestly, the passage I just read to you is not an easy passage to read or to teach. Unfortunately, other commentators say the same thing, so I know I'm not alone in it. And part of the reason that it's difficult to read and difficult to teach on is because what I just read to you is one long run-on sentence. Just one sentence that just goes on and on and on. Now, in the English translation, it's broken up a little bit. They've put in some punctuation, but in the original language, in the original Greek, it's just one long, continuous thought that's kind of hard to pull apart and make sense of. Another thing that makes this a difficult passage is that, quite frankly, from our standards in terms of English, it's really bad grammar. John begins with a series of dependent clauses, which is not good grammar, and you don't get to the actual main subject and main verb until you get to our verse 3. So, Kathy Jo, if you were grading John, you would say good content, bad grammar. Okay, it's hard to read. So what I'm going to do is take this passage and try to, instead of untangle it verse by verse, I just want to focus on what I see are three main points that John wants us to get. And what is it he's trying to get us to? He's trying to get us back to this thing that he says that you have heard from the beginning, that you know to be true. Let this sink into you deeply. What is it that he wants to sink deeply into us? Well, the first thing that John wants to really tell us, really get a hold of, is simply this, that Jesus Christ really lived. He really lived. He wasn't a figment of someone's imagination. He wasn't a great idea. He was an actual person who really lived. And this is important because John is writing this letter at a fairly precarious time in the development of the early Christian church. The letter of 1 John was written late in the first century, probably somewhere between 70 to 90 AD. So what that means is most of the first Christians, most of the Christians who actually met Jesus, who had interaction with him, most of those people are now dead. John is one of the few remaining original apostles, and there aren't many people who are around when Jesus actually walked and talked on the earth. And so, who is John writing to? John's not writing to people who knew Jesus personally. John is now writing to what you might call second or even third generation Christians. A second-generation Christian is someone whose parents maybe had known Jesus or maybe had been present when he taught or had some kind of interaction with him, but they themselves were not present during Jesus' life. Or a third-generation Christian would be someone whose grandparents perhaps had interaction with Jesus, but their parents didn't, and certainly they didn't. So you have people now, Christians, who are maybe 50 years removed from when Jesus was physically present on earth. And what happens after 2 to 3 generations as you begin to move away in time from the original? Well, what happens is things can begin to get a little bit ragged. People who weren't there when it all happened, who are now 2 or 3 generations removed, they start to ask questions. They start to have doubts. They start to wonder, was it really that way? Or was some of this stuff embellished? Was some of it made up? Was there stuff that was added on that's really not part of it? And during this time, there are certain heresies and certain false teachings that are now beginning to creep into the Christian church. One of them was what was called Docetism. Docetism said that Jesus was divine, and because he was divine, he couldn't possibly have died. You can't be a divine being and die. So what happened on the cross was you had a divine being, and then at the last moment, right before the crucifixion, Jesus basically flew away and an image of him was left, and that was what actually was crucified. But it wasn't the real Jesus, because Jesus, the divine Jesus, couldn't die. So you have different teachings about Jesus. One teaching who says, yeah, he's divine, he's not human. Another one who says he's only human and he's not divine. All kinds of teachings are beginning to creep in, and you don't have the original people to say, no, this is how it really was. And these are the people that now John is writing to, second and third generation Christians. I'm curious, how many of you are a first generation Christian, meaning that your parents weren't Christians, you didn't grow up in a Christian home, but sometime in your life, you came to faith in Jesus. Is there anyone who's a first-generation Christian? Okay, we have a couple, a few. Okay, not too many. All right, how many of you are second-generation Christians? Your parents became Christians sometime in their life, therefore you grew up in a Christian home. Okay, we have a few more. How many of you had grandparents who were Christians, therefore your parents were Christians and you grew up in the faith? Okay, a lot more. How many of you go back maybe 4 or 5 generations? Okay. Now, if you just look around, most of you are 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th generation. A few of us are 1st generation. I myself am a 5th generation, not just Christian, but Adventist. Okay, it runs deep. Or some might say shallow. I don't know. But here's the thing. It's very hard for first generation Christians to mix and mingle with 2nd and 3rd generation Christians. Why is that? Because a first generation Christian, they have had the firsthand experience of what not being a Christian is like. They have the perspective. And so they have a certain appreciation for what Jesus and Christianity bring to their life based on personal experience. Those of us who are born into the faith, we have certain advantages, meaning that the Bible, the gospel, church, I mean, these have just always been part of it. And so we have this rich history, this rich tradition that we've just always been steeped in. However, we don't have that appreciation for what the alternative is like. And so sometimes we don't value our faith the way a first generation Christian does. And we're a little bit more prone to question things and doubt things and say, is that really the way it is? Is some of the stuff made up? Is the experience really like that? And you know who gets really annoyed when we start having those doubts and questions? The first generation Christians, because they're like, how can you guys not appreciate this? Don't you know what you have? You're questioning and doubting it. What are you doing that for? And the second and third generation Christians are looking at the first generation's ones and saying, you know, it's so nice that you're on fire for your faith, but just wait a little while. You'll be where we are. And so we have to start different churches for the different groups because we have a hard time getting along. But most of you, as you saw by your hands, most of you are second, third, fourth, fifth generation Christians. And so John is writing to people just like you. People just like you who were born and raised in the faith. So these were people who, again, they were not present when Jesus preached and taught and when he died and when he was resurrected. They didn't know Jesus personally. And so they're going on hearsay on what they've been taught. And enough time has passed now, about 50 years, that these people are starting to have questions, they're starting to have doubts, they're starting to hear these other teachings about Jesus that are different than the what they'd traditionally been taught. And they're saying, is it really that way? Maybe what we thought about Jesus wasn't really true after all. And John comes along, and John says to these people, look, I saw him, is what John says. We saw him. And when he says we, he's talking about him and the other first generation Christians. We saw him with our own eyes, he says. We saw him heal the sick. We saw him raise the dead. We saw him multiply fish and loaves of bread. We saw it with our own eyes. We were there. We were present. We saw when he calmed the sea. We saw when Lazarus actually came back to life. This is not made up stuff. We were really there. We were firsthand eyewitnesses to this. He says, we saw him. And then he goes on to say, he says, we heard him. Maybe John is thinking back to when the time when they heard Jesus teach and preach. You know, we heard him say, blessed are the poor in spirit. We heard him say, I and my Father are one. We heard it with our own ears, he says. We're not going on hearsay. We were there. And then he says, we even touched him. We even touched him with our own hands. You know, John was called the beloved disciple. And we're told that at the Last Supper that he leaned against Jesus. In fact, in the famous painting of the Last Supper, you can see John leaning into Jesus. And maybe John is remembering when he actually leaned against Jesus at the Last Supper. He actually touched flesh and blood. Not a ghost, not some figment of his imagination, but a real person. And John says, we touched him with our hands. He was flesh and blood. Maybe he's thinking of the time that after Thomas had his doubts, where Jesus appeared and Jesus said to Thomas, look, reach out and touch me. A ghost does not have flesh and blood. So John is saying, we saw him, we heard him, we touched him with our own hands. He was a real live person. This is not made up. You know, it's kind of like when the iPhone came out back in 2007. You know, there was all the hype about it, how it had this touch screen and you can do all this stuff. And we heard about it. And then I remember one day Mark Ward showed up at church with one of these things. And I said, Mark, can I see that? But what I meant was, I don't want to look at it, man. I got to get my hands on that thing. I got to see if I really swipe and all that stuff that it says it does when I touch it with my fingers. And John is saying, we touched him. We touch flesh and blood. And John knows that these second and third generation Christians need to know that. And what I think he would say to us, who are now, what, 50th generation, or I don't know how far removed we are, he would say the same thing. Look, we saw him, we heard him, we touched him. He's not make-believe. And I know that a lot of time has come and the message has been corrupted, but you got to know he was a real live human being. And so John's first point that he says, you've just got to go deep with this. This just has to be deeply embedded in you, is that Jesus really lived.
Amen.
That's point number one, that Jesus really lived. Then the second thing that John really wants to go deep on is to tell us that not only did they touch, hear, see Jesus, but they experienced Jesus. According to John, John is saying, not only did we know Jesus, but Jesus changed our lives. He wasn't just a historical figure, he was a transformative figure. And just to kind of explain this, let me just give you a very quick grammar lesson based on how the Greek language works, because it's similar to English in this. John doesn't say, we saw him, we heard him, we touched him. What he actually says in the Greek is, we have seen him, we have touched him, we have heard him. You know what the past tense is, where you say, we saw, we heard, we touched? That means, well, it's a historical event. It's something that happened in the past. But when you say, we have seen him, we have touched him, we have heard him, what it's called is, I believe it's the perfect tense, meaning it happened in the past, but the effect of it is ongoing. It's continuing to affect who we are right now. I mean, just a very simple example, you could say, I went to Yosemite. Okay, I'm telling you a historical fact. I went to Yosemite. But if I say, I have been to Yosemite, now I'm telling you, not only was I there, but I saw Half Dome. I saw the trees. I saw the waterfalls. And it had an impression on me that I'm still carrying with me to this day. And that's what John is saying here. Not just that it's something that happened in the past, but it's continuing into the present. Maybe John is thinking about the fact that, you know, I was there when he taught, and I was there when he did these miracles, and it's continuing to resonate inside of me. It's continuing to affect the way I carry myself, and the way I talk to people, and the way I handle myself. And he says, I you know, it's like I continue to hear his voice inside me. It's not just something in the past, but I continue to hear his voice, you know, through the Word, through the Bible, and I continue to hear his voice through the Spirit inside me. And I continue to hear his voice through people around me. This week I got a text message that was totally unsolicited. And it was somebody who, I mean, it was their words, but it was something that was prompted by the Holy Spirit. This person spends time on a regular basis with God in personal devotions. And occasionally, this person will, out of that experience, text message me something that he experienced, or a realization, or something out of his experience with God. And this week, out of his experience with God, he sent me a text, and I want to read it to you. This came to me on Tuesday. It said, Pastor Dennis, there is one who desires to do damage to your soul, but God loves you and will not permit it. He loves you as he loved David. Remember to maintain the spiritual practices you taught us. Remember, God knows your name.
Wow.
Now, that's powerful. It came from a person. Well, it came through a person. But it's the voice of God. And see, what John would have us know is that the voice of Jesus isn't just something that spoke 2,000 years ago, but it's something that continues to speak to us today.
Hallelujah.
Through the Bible, through other people's words, and through the prompting inside our own heart. It's an experience. It's not just a fact, but it's an experience. And so John says, I didn't just touch him, I didn't just see him, I experienced him. In fact, John says, the Word is life. Who Jesus was and the things he said are in and of themselves life-giving. They breathe life into me, and it's now part of who I am. And perhaps this is an appropriate time to just stop and ask, do you know what that means? If you grew up in the church, if you're a second, third, fourth, fifth generation, whatever, you know the truths, you know the doctrines, you know the facts. But is Jesus a source of life? I mean, does he breathe into you? Or is he just a historical figure? Because there's a big difference. And what John wants us to know is, you don't have to have been there like I was 2,000 years ago to have this ongoing experience with him. You, as second and third generation and 50th generation Christians, you can have this too. Yeah, we didn't have the privilege of seeing and touching and hearing him, but we can experience him today. So, what does John want us to know? That Christianity is more than just a religion. It's an experience of knowing Jesus personally. And out of this experience comes depth, joy, and life, and abundance. So, John says, go deep on this, on the fact that Jesus really lived, and that we have really experienced him, and you can experience him too. And then that's really the third thing that John wants us to know is you can go deep in this experience with Jesus now. I want you to listen as I read verse 3, going back to 1 John. Verse 3 says, we proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you may also have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. John says, we proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you may have fellowship with us and fellowship with God. Now, the word fellowship, the Greek word for that is koinonia. Koinonia simply means to share or to have something in common. Fellowship. And John is saying, you can have the same kind of fellowship with Jesus that I had. Even though I got to touch and see and experience him, you can have that too. And in fact, John says, unless you have that experience, that my experience is incomplete. Listen to what he says in verse 4. He says, we write this to make our joy complete. He doesn't say to make your joy complete. He says, we write this to make our joy complete. It's like John's saying, if you don't get this, if you don't have this experience, then what I had with Jesus is not going to be complete. As good as it was, it's not going to be complete. Simple example. Let's say you find a brand new restaurant, and you love this restaurant. I mean, everything about it is good. The food is good. The service is good. The ambiance is unique. I mean, this, on your way home, you say to whoever's with you, that was the best restaurant I've ever been to. And you have joy because of this new restaurant. So the next day you go and you tell some of your friends about this new restaurant. And the next weekend, these friends of yours, they go to this new restaurant, and they experience the food and the service and the ambiance, and they come back and they said, man, that was a wonderful, that's the best restaurant I've ever went to. And now you have joy because of their experience. But then the following weekend, you say, why don't all of us go to that restaurant? And so you all go to the restaurant, and you all try stuff off the menu, and you all share different things that you've ordered, and you end up staying until they kick you out. And on your way home, you realize you have joy, but your joy is different than the first time you were at the restaurant, because your joy is now complete by the other people's having that shared experience with you. Your joy has been made complete. And that is what John is talking about. He says, this is the Christian experience. That the Christian experience, the experience of knowing Jesus, is incomplete until it's been shared with other Christians. And I can't emphasize this enough. So often we want to have our Christian experience be a solitary experience, just me and Jesus. And the New Testament knows nothing about that. What the New Testament knows about is that Christianity is a shared experience. It's not just you and Jesus, because just you and Jesus over time can become very narcissistic and very selfish. You need other people. And John says, my experience with Christ isn't going to be complete until you have it too, and we can share it together. I want you to listen to what Gary Berge, who's a commentator, says about this specific verse, 1 John 1, 1-4. He says, Christian community is the common living of people who have a shared experience of Jesus Christ. They talk about this experience. They urge each other to grow more deeply in it. And they discover that through it, they begin to build a life together, unlike any shared life in the world. So going deeper in our Christianity, whether it's this year or next year or whenever, always involves going deeper and sharing it with other Christians, other believers. Sharing our experience with them and receiving theirs. And we find that our joy is made full. So, John's first lesson in going deep is this. If you really want to go deep in faith, first of all, you've got to know that it's about knowing that Jesus really lived, continuing to experience the living Jesus as a source of life, and then having a shared experience with other believers who are having something similar to that. And so that's why my vision, if you want to call it that, or my desire for us as a church for this coming year, yeah, I want you to go deeper in your faith, but not by yourself. I want it to be a shared experience. Because you need that. We all need that. There's a commentary on 1 John, and one of the things it says about the book of 1 John is it says it's a loving and anxious sermon written by a pastor who loved his people and wanted God's best for them. When I read that, I was struck by the phrase, a loving and anxious sermon. And I thought, boy, that's me a lot of times. There are things I want for the congregation. I want it out of love because I know it's good for them. But how do I get it to them? I'm anxious for them to have it, but how do I do that? I guess John had that same experience. He gets that. And so what I want for each one of you is like I just said, it's for us to go deeper with Christ in 2012, to know him personally, for him to be a source of life, but not to do it by ourselves, but to do it in a shared way. And I would like to ask that you make that your prayer as well, that you would go deeper with Jesus this year, but not just in a solitary way, but that God would bring other people into your life who you can share that experience with. so that your experience can be complete.